This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here today with David Cole, aka David Stein. Hey, David.
How you doing? Great to be on the show.
Great. So you have a new book out. It's called Republican Party Animal.
Yes, it's been out now for about a week and a half, and it's in paperback, also available on Kindle from Amazon. And I'm biased, of course, but so far all the feedback's been pretty good.
And have you gotten a lot of feedback from mainstream publications or?
No, actually, just the opposite, Robert. The mainstream publications are putting a pretty tight clamp down on talking about the book. Reviews of the book have been initiated in three different major newspapers: the LA Times, the New York Post, and the Guardian. The reviews and or features about the book, and in all three cases, the features and or reviews were killed by the editors. There is a tremendous reluctance on the part of the mainstream press to talk about the book or to allow their writers to talk about the book. And it's gotten so bad that just a few days ago, my publisher, Feral House Publishing, a mainstream publishing company, they do a lot of counterculture and pop culture type books. They found out that certain periodicals will not even accept a paid advertisement for the book, for my book. Even newspapers that are economically dying on their last legs will turn up a check rather than have a simple advertisement for my book.
So it's more that they're trying to silence it than smear it.
Oh, yeah, there is a complete cone of silence, I could say, over the book. They would much rather people not know it exists. Even a negative review will still give publicity to a book. And so they don't even want it reviewed negatively, although I did get a look at one of those pieces, or at least a condensation of one of the pieces that was killed, and it would have been a positive review if it had been allowed to run. But even a negative review would still have given the book publicity. So they're just trying to make sure nobody knows it's out there.
I mean, it is the book is called Republican Party Animal, so it's about the Republican Party in a sense. Have you gotten, how has the reaction been from say the partisan Republicans versus the partisan Democrats to the book?
Well, just to let your listeners know, the book is really in two parts. The first part very extensively covers my years as a Holocaust revisionist from about 1989 through about 97. And that was when I was David Cole. And then the second half of the book covers my time with the GOP as David Stein. That part, the book actually has a real tonal shift right in the middle of it, because the Holocaust revisionist part and the historical part is very serious and covers very serious topics. And then the part about the Republicans is much more breezy and anecdotal and funny. And then I try to wrap everything up in the final chapter. The Republicans don't speak to me anymore. I was officially banned from many GOP groups last year when I was outed. And when I say banned, I mean in se several cases, I was actually served with a notice of lifetime banishment, that where I couldn't even come to certain events as a guest, let alone as a member. So the Republicans don't speak to me at all. The left, and I'm not really limiting that to just Democrats, but I would just say the left in general, they've been interested in the book. Probably the left has been the only group that has shown an interest in terms of larger websites talking about
Is
the
part
book.
of it is kind of like they want to be like, see, yeah, Republicans really are racist.
Yeah, a part of it is that it's amusing to them that a man who, like me, who they refer to as a Holocaust denier, I don't refer to myself that way, and indeed I am not a denier, but the left refers to me as one. And I think to them it's very amusing that the GOP had what they call a Holocaust denier operating right under their noses, along with some of the biggest names, conservative names in Hollywood, like Clint Eastwood and Gary Sinise, Jerry Bruckheimer, and all of these really big names who I worked with in those days, in the Republican days. So the left, they of course, they would like to use it to smear the GOP and Republicans. But so far, the left has treated me rather fairly. And in fact, The Guardian, which is a left-leaning newspaper, The Guardian was the newspaper, the British paper that outed me in the first place a year ago. And The Guardian, the reporter from The Guardian, a fellow named Rory Carroll, who wrote the piece, he and I have stayed in touch. He's been generally fair with me. He hasn't taken any cheap shots. And the left has been not as ruthless as it could be. The right, on the other hand, has been either silent, or if they talk about me, it is in the sense of that effing traitor, that to hell with him, we are never to mention that name again, etc. So I don't get a lot of feedback from the right.
I notice a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is that the left is more, they do it more loyalty towards their own people who do stuff. I notice the Republicans are very ruthless in the sense if one of their own people says something politically correct, they're very ruthless when it comes to throwing them under the bus.
Yeah, that was something where, you know, part of the reason for that, Robert, is that the Republicans operate under a belief, which I think is somewhat justified. I don't think this is a crazy belief. The Republicans operate under a belief that they're never going to get a fair shake in the mainstream press. And therefore, because of this little shade of paranoia they have about the mainstream press, and as I said, I'm not saying that's unjustified, but because of this bit of paranoia that they have, they'll cut what they see as an infected limb off really, really quickly, because they know if they don't, the press is going to keep pounding them with it and pounding them with it and pounding with it. A person on the Democrat side can say, a Democrat politician or a lower down on the food chain, a Democrat strategist or campaign manager or precinct walker or whatever, can say something ridiculous, and it might get covered in Breitbart or Daily Caller, but you won't see Scott Pelley on CBS News making that the lead story. Campaign worker in Illinois says something stupid. On the Republican side, on the other hand, if a Republican, no matter where on the food chain they are, if they say something that, especially if it seems to be racist or sexist or something like that, then it's going to be on all three networks. It's going to be on the New York Times, it's going to be in the LA Times and the Washington Post. So there's been a fear of God beaten into the Republicans about the mainstream press. And as a result, the Republicans do kick their own out and throw them under the bus pretty quickly, because otherwise they're afraid they're just going to keep hearing about this again and again. When I was outed a year ago, it was covered in many, many mainstream sites and by many mainstream news organizations. I would have left on my own accord if the GOP-related groups had not banned me, because it was not my intention to bring any undue continued misery to the people I had befriended over my Republican years. But if I had been stubborn and refused to leave and tried to fight the banishment, then the press just would have kept playing on that. They would have kept making an issue out of that for months. And that's not the way I wanted to get publicity. And of course, the GOP didn't want to get that kind of publicity. Writing a book is a different thing, because yes, I do hope to get publicity from the book, but I hope that the book is something that explains me well, and perhaps even if not acquits me, at least makes my case a bit more easy to understand than one might have gotten from reading about it on Yahoo News or the Huffington Post or MSN or where else.
And ideologically, were you sympathetic to the views of the Republican Party Or were you just sort of using it as a platform to, or as a career move?
Well, as I say in the book, I don't consider myself pro-conservative as much as I consider myself anti-left wing. Now, I'm not the first one to state it that way. The creators of South Park, Parker and Stone, that's how they describe themselves when people say about South Park, "Yeah, it's a pretty conservative leaning show." And they say it's not so much we're conservatives, it's just that we really, really, really hate the left. And so that's not an original thought on my part, but it does help explain the kind of ideological beliefs I have. There's a lot in today's conservatism and today's Republican Party that I don't agree with. And in fact, I made my views clear about that a lot during my time with the GOP. I wasn't a silent bystander. I was in a position where, in fact, I was able to voice my objections, and I got into my share of clashes with other people on the conservative side. People including Andrew Breitbart, people including a woman named Pam Geller, and a guy named Robert Spencer, who's
So you're
right over
saying they
there.
were hostile towards you back then?
Well, it was a friendly hostility in that they saw me as being on their side, but we disagreed about things. But I was always anti-leftist. I've always been against the excesses, the economic theories, the political correctness, the racial views, everything pretty much that the left propagates, with only a few exceptions. But generally speaking, if it's leftist, it's not going to agree with me.
So you would just would you describe yourself as sort of like a Pat Buchanan type?
Well, Pat Buchanan, though, could also, he has in the past been described as a nativist, somebody who I think improperly applies concepts of race and culture to North America. North America to me is a melting pot. I'm not a nativist in terms of how I view racial matters. When I talk about the things the left says about race that tick me off, I'm primarily talking about things like affirmative action, political correctness in schools, racial political correctness in the arts and entertainment, censorship of things that are deemed to be racist, and just the willy-nilly thoughtless bandying around of the term racist, which does have a definition, but is almost entirely always misused by the left.
And you're obviously you're being Jewish, that hasn't gotten you off the hook for your views.
Oh, just the opposite, frankly. Me being Jewish has always made me more of a target. It made me more of a target in my revisionist days. I was one of the very few American revisionists to suffer violent consequences in the 90s. Other revisionists were beaten up elsewhere. A Frenchman named Robert Forzin was beaten rather badly in France. And of course, revisionists in Europe and Canada have been put in prison or put on trial. But in America, generally speaking, revisionists were not beaten up and certainly were not tried in court because there's no law against being revisionist in the United States. But because I was Jewish, I attracted the attention, the unwanted attention of groups like the Jewish Defense League, a very thuggish, almost paramilitary Jewish organization. I got beat up three times by them, and finally they put a bounty on my head of $25,000, which is one of the reasons I left the field in late '97. And nowadays, now with my former Republican friends, being Jewish earned me nothing. But once I was outed, it earned me nothing but continued cries of traitor, self-hater, bad Jew. The interesting thing is, some of the Jews among the GOP crowd, some of the Jews who attacked me verbally the hardest were the atheist Jews. Like three of my very good friends, one really, really good friend from my GOP circles, who was an atheist Jew, probably reacted the most negatively of anyone. and a couple of others, including a fairly well-known blogger who's an atheist, who came out swinging really badly against me, even though I had always been very helpful to him during my Republican years. This I attribute to the fact that for a lot of Jews, the Holocaust has actually become a replacement religion, a religion unto itself. For a lot of Jews who don't buy into Old Testament theology, the Holocaust has become their religion. I could even expand that and say the concept of persecution has become their faith. So that's one of the reasons where I've frequently gotten a lot more flack from atheist Jews than I get from religious Jews. And in fact, Orthodox Jews have never really come after me all that much. I would feel safer with my identity known now. I'd feel safer at an Orthodox Jewish center on Fairfax in LA than I would at some intellectual retreat made up of atheist elitist Jews reading Nietzsche and Hitchens and Penn and Teller. Those guys, not Penn and Teller, but those Jews who would be part of that group, they're the ones who'd probably really give me a hard time. The Orthodox Jews really have never given me much of a hard time.
Yeah, I'm sure you're familiar with Luke Ford. He's a Gentile who converted to Orthodox Judaism, and he basically makes the same observations.
Yeah, and even a lot of people who are very anti-revisionist, people like Deborah Lipstadt and some other Jewish proponents of the Orthodox Holocaust story, even they have made that point. Deborah Lipstadt wrote a piece sometime in the 80s about the danger of the Holocaust becoming a pseudo religion, and it certainly has happened. It's happened at least since the 70s, when the term Holocaust became popularized, and at the same time, actual religious faith among American Jews was waning. So you had this dynamic that started in the 70s and throughout the 80s and 90s, and now I had a friend who I speak about in my book, who's an Orthodox rabbi, and he made the point that that you can be in a room full of Jews and you can say, I don't believe in God. I think the Old Testament's a bunch of folklore from the ancient days, and people may disagree with you, but they'll give you the right to have that opinion, and they won't attack you and beat you by and large. But you could be in that same room of full of Jews, and you can say Auschwitz was not an extermination camp, and you'll be lucky to get out of there with your hide intact. So that there's something fundamentally wrong. In fact, that atheist Jewish blogger who I mentioned a few minutes ago, his name's Eric Golub, and he sent me an email sometime after my outing where he said something along the lines of, your revisionist views, your views on Auschwitz are an insult to 4,000 years of Jewish history. There are so many ways in which a statement like that is ridiculous. First of all, whatever happened at Auschwitz only happened from 1941 through 1945. So how it can impact thousands of years ago is beyond me. But there is something fundamentally wrong where a guy is claiming that a certain position on history, on a historical and a fairly recent historical matter in the big scheme of things, that is somehow an insult that goes back 4,000 years. It's just ridiculous. It's very over the top. But those are the kind of over the top insults and emails and criticisms and things that I've had to deal with ever since my outing. And I had to deal with them in the old days too, so I'm kind of used to it.
How have your Jewish family members reacted to your views? Have you had any like relatives or close family friends disown you for that?
My views were controversial among my family back in my active revisionist days in the early 90s, and it was quite a controversy among my family back then. Eventually, most of them simply came to tolerate it not necessarily like it, but tolerate it. And then after 97, when I left the field, it just became something that was forgotten because I went on to do other things. And most of my good family members, my close family members, they know the woman who outed me. So they don't necessarily blame me for being in this position. They know that I was outed against my will by an exceptionally vindictive, unpleasant human being.
Reminds me of the Donald Sterling case.
You hit that one right on the head there, Robert. I have my own V. Stiviano. Instead of getting $100 million from me, she only got about $200,000 because I ain't no Donald Sterling when it comes to the money department. But yeah, for about 5 years, she lived off of me and I supported her and gave her whatever she wanted. And when the money finally ran out and I cut her off, this was the one bargaining chip she had, the one way to get back at me, and she used it. But because my family knew her, and they never liked her to begin with, so because of that, they don't really hold my current situation against me, because they know that if it had been up to me, I wouldn't have been outed. So they're sympathetic to the fact that I'm reluctantly in this position.
Do you have any Holocaust survivors in your family?
No, I don't. People have asked me that from even the earliest days because they've assumed that maybe I went into this field because of family connection. My family was very fortunate in that both sides of it were either in the United States or Great Britain during the war, and none of them ever fell under Nazi Germany control. I started studying this because in the late 80s, it was a subject where there was a lot of work to be done. The Soviet Union had started to release documents and give access to archives in Moscow and archaeological sites. You could now travel freely to the Eastern Bloc and back, and there was a lot of work to be done. The Holocaust wasn't my interest when I was a younger man. When I was in high school, I was keenly interested in early American history and Revolutionary War history, but most of the discoveries had already been made. Most of the work had already been done. People could still put new spins on things, but it's very unlikely that we're going to see any newly discovered letters between Adams and Jefferson. Most of what's out there is known. I wanted to get into a field where there was still a lot that was unknown.
So at what point did you become interested in the Holocaust?
Well, right around the time that, right around 89, when I realized that there were holes in the standard story. And the main reason I realized that was because, and I go into detail about this in the book, all throughout the 1980s, the Canadian government had very stupidly, recklessly put a man named Ernst Zundel on trial. They put him on trial twice because of his crime of being a revisionist. And yet the Canadians, at the same time that they did something that is very one could say fascist, which is putting this man on trial, a show trial essentially in other countries, but the Canadians didn't want to make it a show trial. They wanted to be all democratic about it and all progressive. So they let Zundel mount a completely vigorous defense. You see, if you're put on trial in Germany for being a revisionist, you're not allowed to defend yourself. Truth is not a defense to this charge in a German court. Your choices are limited. You can plead insanity. You can say, I'm wrong because I'm crazy. Or you can plead for forgiveness. I'm wrong. Please don't put me in prison. I'm so sorry. But you can't say, but I'm right. When the Canadians put Zundel on trial both times, they allowed him to mount a defense of, but I'm right. And he was able to call witnesses, and then even more importantly, he was able to cross-examine, his lawyer, Doug Christie, was able to cross-examine the Crown's witnesses, including eyewitnesses from Auschwitz, and including people like Raoul Hilberg, one of the most respected Holocaust authors of his time. So what you got in the Zundel trial, in both Zundel trials, you had one of the most vigorous peer review processes I had ever seen. You had two sides hitting each other with their various claims and counterclaims and battling it out in a courtroom under oath. That's fascinating because history is typically not decided that way. History generally, when there's a debate, it's done civilly. Historians exchange essays and critique each other's essays and counter-critique that critique. But to have it all in a courtroom under oath where the defendant is facing actual jail time if he can't make his case, that had not really been done before. And following the Zundel trial and hearing all of the instances in which the supposed experts admitted they didn't know what they were talking about, admitted that they were wrong or that they were basing things on incomplete information, or the survivors saying, well, the thing that I said that I saw with my own eyes was actually something I heard from someone else who heard it from someone else. That piqued my curiosity. I think it would have piqued the curiosity of many people had the subject not been so taboo.
So you're basically saying if there was total free speech on that issue, there would be a lot less Holocaust revisionism, probably.
Well, if there were free speech, especially in Western Europe, because World War II is always going to be a more important and more personal thing in Europe than it will be in the United States or Canada. If people could simply speak freely and debate this topic freely without fear of imprisonment, without fear of getting beaten up, without fear of losing their job, I think cooler heads will always prevail in a case like that. There are people who justifiably can be called Holocaust deniers, people who say nothing happened, people who say no Jews were killed.
And there are, I mean, that point of view I think actually is crazy. But some of those types who are they even deny there was any genocide, they're like attacking people like Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review for his views, because he basically acknowledges there was a genocide. Like those people like that.
Very, very good point, Robert, because Mark Weber has been a friend of mine for almost 25 years, and he's probably the most learned and astute historian I know, and certainly a man I would consider a mentor of mine. And when I was forced back into this field last year after my outing, I hadn't been following it much at all because I was very busy with my Republican political stuff. So when I was forced back and I tried to get a lay of the land and figure out, okay, how's everyone doing who I haven't spoken to in years? And I was astounded to read some of the attacks against Mark. And to a lesser extent, people are attacking David Irving as well, another fine, fine historian. But Mark Weber, especially, the attacks against him, the insults, and the names that he is called, when everything he says and everything he has said about the Holocaust and where his views are about it, they all make perfect sense. Mark doesn't say things on a whim or a lark. He's actually, I used to make fun of how proper he is, even in a social setting. He's just one of the most proper, upright guys. He never goes off half-cocked saying things that don't have a basis in fact. And when I read some of the things that had been thrown his way, some of the insults, it was sickening to me, frankly.
Yeah, I think the word to use is objective, because I think on both extremes of the issues, there's people who will distort the truth for their political agenda. And it's not just one side or the other. There's people who do that on both ends.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think the more open dialogue that we can have about it, the people on the extreme fringes of both sides will always be the loudest. But common sense has its own power, I've always found. In fact, even today, I've had the opportunity, I mean, even in the past year, in my current life as the Republican in exile, I've had the opportunity to sit down with some of my old Republican friends who initially didn't like me anymore. But you give me a few hours to talk to someone, one-on-one, and explain myself, which is what I hope I do in my book, so that by proxy I can do that with a lot more people. But one-on-one, if I can speak to someone about this, I think the common sense of what I say typically comes through. I've had a lot of people, at least over a dozen, maybe close to 20, of my former Republican friends have a sit down with me, and I explain myself to them. They ask me questions, and I answer them. And at the end of it, they don't have to come away agreeing with me. That's not a condition of me being friends with somebody or a condition of me living in peace with someone. I don't ask that they agree with me, but by the end of that talk, they'll usually come away saying, well, he's not crazy. He's making a certain amount of sense, and he's not an anti-Semitic lunatic, racist, evil lunatic. And that's really all that I ask for. I don't demand anyone see things my way, but I'm not the monster that the other side often portrays me as.
I think kind of like the joke is like people will say being a Jewish Holocaust revisionist is kind of like that Dave. Have you ever seen the Dave Chappelle skit of the black Klansman who's blind?
Yes, yeah, I did see that.
I guess that's how some people might look at it. But anyways. What has your experience been? Have there been many Holocaust survivors who have been willing to have a dialogue with you?
Not too many. I mean, certainly none these days. But of course, 20 years ago when I was doing this full time, there were a lot more survivors around. The example that I like to give about one of the few times I did get the opportunity to debate or at least discuss with a survivor was when I did the Montel Williams show. Mark Weber and I both did that show in early 92. And the producer, this was at CBS Studios, and the producer brought on a man named Ernest Hollander, who had been at Auschwitz in 1944. Now, one of my strongest positions, one of my most controversial positions, is that not only was Auschwitz not an extermination camp, but the somewhere between 500 and 600,000 Jews that passed through there in 44, primarily from Hungary, but also from Czechoslovakia, that those Jews were not sent there to be killed. They were sent there to be divided up for labor. So the Montel Williams producer brought on this fellow, Ernest Hollander, who had been one of those 1944 Jews. He was a Czech Jew, and he and his brother had been taken by the Nazis in 44. And Ernst Hollander, the fellow who was there to debate me, of course he didn't address me directly. He wouldn't speak to me directly, but he made a big point about how dare I say that his brother wasn't killed. His brother was killed, and it's a horror for me to say that it didn't happen. Now, when the Montel episode aired, a fellow in New York, who was watching the episode, he said, "Huh, that Ernst Hollander guy, the Czech Jew who was at Auschwitz, looks just like my downstairs neighbor Zoltan Hollander, who's a Czech Jew who was at Auschwitz." Both brothers thought the other one was dead. Both brothers thought the other one had been killed.
So, in a sense, you were responsible for reuniting them.
Indeed, I mean that. The thing is, the Montel Williams show heard about this story, and they had the reunion of the two brothers on the Montel Williams show some weeks later. Now, I was not invited to the reunion, and I was never given credit. But the simple fact is, if Weber and I had not been on the show, and if Ernest Hollander hadn't been on the show, those two brothers would have gone to their graves not knowing that the other one was alive. And Ernest Hollander lived nearly 20 years after that. So he got about two decades with his brother and all the other extended family that he wouldn't have had otherwise. And the reason, I just want to make the point to your listeners, the reason that this terrible, terrible mistake in belief, that both brothers thinking that the other was dead, the reason this happened was one brother ended up on the western side the Allied Western side after the war, and the other brother ended up on the Soviet side, because that was what would happen to people in places like Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and a lot of those other countries that would fall on either one side or the other side of the Iron Curtain. If you were unlucky enough to fall on the Soviet side of the curtain, you were not able to leave freely. And either way, whatever side you fell on, you were told that if you don't see your family members right in front of you at this refugee camp, that means they're dead. So Ernest Hollander, on the Western side, was told after the war, "Oh, your family's dead. Don't bother looking for him." And Zoltan Hollander on the Soviet side was told, "Your family's dead. Plus, you can't leave to go look for him anyway. So just get used to it." And it wasn't until the Soviet Union relaxed its travel rules that Zoltan Hollander was able to travel to New York and move there, and that's how the whole reunion happened. Because, like you said, if the show hadn't have happened, those two brothers never would have been reunited. Now, if it had been up to me, I wanted to mount a massive effort back then in '92 to try to make other reunions like that happen. But the media was not welcoming of my message. I did some more shows after that, but most of them were really bad. In fact, the Montel Williams show is the only one I can recall where the host was fair, the audience wasn't stacked, and I was able to. Weber also, we were able to speak freely. Every other show I did after the Montel Williams show, either the host was hostile and cut me off constantly, or it was a show like 60 Minutes that's edited after the fact. And so I don't get to say anything that Mike Wallace doesn't want me to say because he's in charge and his producers are in charge of the editing. So I never got much of a fair shake again after the Montel show.
And I noticed the Phil Donahue appearance was pretty famous as well.
Yeah, that one was famous, I think, because of how contentious it was. Phil was a very, very hostile host. His producer, a guy named Brad Hurtado, who is still a producer in TV today, Brad Hurtado was a very fair man and allowed me to show clips, video clips of some of my trips to the campsites in Europe, not just Auschwitz, but Majdanek, Mauthausen, and a couple of others. Donahue, I don't think he was expecting that, and he got very angry at me as the show went on, and it got to the point where the halfway mark, about the 30-minute mark through the show, I walked off, not on camera, because I knew I would be accused of trying to make a media sensation of myself by storming off on camera. But during the commercial break, I went back to my dressing room and I took off. Brad Hurtado, the producer, he didn't want me to leave, but Donahue was more than happy when I was gone. And so I think the thing that people find fascinating about that show, or at least the first 30 minutes when I'm on it, is the hostile back and forth between me and Donahue. Donahue wouldn't let me address the issues I was there to address. He kept going back to, "Have you been bar mitzvahed? Are you a religious Jew? Tell me about your bar mitzvah. Tell me about, have you Ernst Sundel?" And I was a very young man at that time. I was in my very early 20s, and I wasn't handling it well. I'd have more patience for it now, but as a young man hopped up on coffee that particular day, I let it get to me. But it's enjoyable to watch. It certainly is funny to watch me having steam come out of my ears, and Donahue also getting angry and angry when he's not getting his way. And so that makes it fun. It's good TV, I'll say that. Not much was learned, but it was good TV. It was entertaining TV.
I saw you posted a video on your Facebook. It was about the Museum of Tolerance in LA.
Yes. The Museum of Tolerance, which opened in the early 90s, is it's a museum only in that they have that spelled out on the brochures, but it's not a museum by what any rational person would consider a museum. It is a mishmash of multimedia exhibits to let everyone know how intolerant we all are. And then it's kind of a Disneyland guided tour through the Holocaust, through a very distorted version of the
And
Holocaust.
even some very much mainstream historians have actually said that who And these are people who believe, who support the mainstream narrative. They actually find the sort of Disneyland aspect of it to be disrespectful.
Yes, the Museum of Tolerance got a lot of flack when it first opened by people who would disagree with me about Holocaust history. It's vulgar. The Museum of Tolerance is vulgar. It's a shame that it is a required destination for many schools in the LA area for field trips, because it's not even acceptable as a way to teach kids, regardless of the fact the history they're teaching them is false. But the exhibits are made up of some of the most ludicrous laughable ways that you can claim you're teaching any kind of history. It's a terrible place. I don't ever like to recommend people pay the money to go there, but if you're in the LA area and you're looking to see an example of the worst possible way to teach Holocaust history, and you have, well, it used to be $7. I don't know what it is now. You have a few bucks to spend. Go through it, and you'll realize that what the Wiesenthal Center is doing is it's not educating people. It's actually setting the course of education back several decades or more. It's a terrible place. And one of the things I talk about in the video you mentioned, I was able to manipulate the museum into removing phony footage. They were showing supposedly real footage of Jewish children being gassed in a gas van. There were no gas vans. That's one of the things that's completely mythical about Holocaust history. Supposedly these were vans that would fill up with carbon monoxide and gas the people in the back of the van as the Nazi drove it around in circles. And the Wiesenthal Center in the museum, on a never-ending loop, they were showing this black and white footage of Jewish children being gassed in a gas van, and it was all choppy and it looked like it was documentary footage. But I knew, having had enough experience in film industry, I knew that it wasn't documentary footage. I knew that it was a three-camera shoot, and that it had been, then there was much editing involved. And I was able to find out what it was from. It was from a 1962 Polish fictional film called The Ambulance. Now the Wiesenthal Center, I knew Rabbi Heyer. He would never listen to me. Of course, he wouldn't take a phone call from me or a letter or anything. So I knew I couldn't do anything. But I contacted the director of that Polish film, Janusz Morgenstern, and he was living in New York at the time. And I said, "Do you know that your film is playing on a never-ending loop at the Wiesenthal Museum of Tolerance? Have you gotten paid for that? Have you been getting residuals for the fact they're using your film every moment that they're open?" And he lunged at the Wiesenthal Center because, just for financial reasons, they had been using his film without either giving him credit or paying him residuals. And so, to that extent, because of that, by me playing one party against another, the film clip was removed. Janusz Morgenstern died a few years ago, and I'm very curious. I might even go back to the Museum of Tolerance one of these days. I'm curious if they put the gas van footage back now that the only guy who really had a claim against them is dead. I'd be interested to see if they reverted back to it.
And in your book, you talk about when the JDL, they put a well. First, I want to talk a little bit. One thing I will say about the JDL is that they're a really nasty group, but they're a lot more honest and upfront than groups like the Wiesenthal Center and the Anti-Defamation League.
Oh, no question. Absolutely no question. The Irv Rubin, the head of the Jewish Defense League, I always had a very honest relationship with him. That's not to advocate his methods, which included arson, possibly murder, and physical violence. But there was an honesty to his brutality. He never tried to dress it up as anything other than what it was. If he didn't like you and he saw you, he'd punch you, as he did to me several times. It is refreshing because he never claimed to be anything else. He never said he was a historian. He never claimed to be acting on behalf of tolerance or the principles of multiculturalism and tolerance. He was what he was. He was a thug, but he was straightforward. And when I asked him to be released from that $25,000 bounty that the JDL had on me, we negotiated. We negotiated very much like two warring nations would. We came up with a settlement privately. I paid him off, and I gave him a statement of recantation, which was so over the top that only a man like Irv Rubin could have believed it, and which he did. And that was that. He never troubled me again after that. And so there was something, like I said, there was an honesty to his brutality, which is not to be mistaken for an endorsement of his tactics.
When he died in prison, I know one of them commits suicide in the federal jail in L.A., and one of them was killed by, like, a skinhead in a federal prison in Nevada. Did you have a schadenfreude, or did you sort of take the high road?
Oh, well, I took the high road. There was something very childlike about Irv Rubin. I don't want to use the term endearing, but as I said, he never claimed to be anything other than what he was. In fact, even with the charge against him, for the sake of your listeners, what happened was, after 9/11, Irv Rubin and his top lieutenant, Earl Krugel, were busted by the FBI because there was an informant among their JDL ranks, and supposedly the JDL was going to blow up a mosque in Culver City, California, and kill Daryl Issa, Lebanese-American Republican congressman.
Daryl Issa, I mean, he's not necessarily anti-Israel.
No, not at all. And in fact, to my understanding, he's not a Muslim. I believe he's a Lebanese Christian.
So they just hate him for being like an Arab.
Well, I think, and here's where I was going with that. I think most of that was Earl Krugel, the deputy. Rubin, knowing him as I did, and you kind of, you tend to know your enemies really well. Sometimes you know your enemies better than you know your friends. So I like to think that over the course of the many years of tussling with Rubin, I got to know him well. Rubin didn't strike me as the kind of guy who would have come up with that kind of a plan. And Issa, yeah, he's Lebanese American, sure, but he's not a left-wing Cynthia McKinney type who pummels Israel. That's not what Issa is at all. My take on that case is that I think Krugel was the mastermind of that. I think it might have been possible for Irv Rubin to have beaten the rap if he had wanted to or tried hard enough, but Rubin ended up diving off like the 20-story tier inside the prison, also having tried to cut his throat at the same time. There were murmurs that he might have been thrown off, but at the same time, his own lawyer said that Rubin had become despondent and suicidal. I'm not claiming to know one way or the other, but as I said, knowing Rubin as I do, and knowing Krugel as I do, and you can see the difference between these guys in a video clip that I posted earlier in the week, where they were being interviewed about me from, I think, late 91 or early 92. And Rubin is very, he's trying to be charming about it. And he's basically saying, oh, I'd never punch anyone, not David Cole. And the interviewer says, well, I hear that you hit him. And Rubin says, well, if I did, I wouldn't admit it here because it doesn't pay to advertise. He's trying to be funny. He's trying to be charming. Krugel gets in front of the camera and says, if I'd have been there, I'd have laid him out cold. I'd have knocked him dead. Krugel struck me as much more the brutal one and the one who didn't really care about projecting an image. Rubin always tried to at least not be frightening, because when your job description is beating people up, you you're frightening to that extent. And Rubin always wanted to seem like the charming guy who beats people up, the charming guy who will knock you silly. Krugel just came off as a brute, as a straightforward, absolutely no charm involved kind of a brute. The case against Rubin and Krugel never really got sorted out because they both died. Rubin, of course, as I said, he leapt off of a 20-story tier, and Krugel had his skull crushed in the prison weight room by a skinhead. So the story died with those two guys. I'm never happy when anyone dies. I was fairly happy when they were both put away in prison, because I did start to feel a bit safer at that point. But I don't ever wish for anyone to die, not even someone who's tried to make me die.
So, how did you fake your own death?
Well, that, and this is another story that I go into deeply in my book. There's really only one way that a person can fake their death without either leaving too many open ends, or more importantly, without jeopardizing the lives of others. You never want to do something like pretending to die in the woods, go on a hike, because they're going to send hikers after you, and they're going to send helicopters to
Yeah, and
look.
then if you get caught, like you could end up getting held legally responsible for all that money they waste.
Yeah, exactly. And if, God forbid, a helicopter crashes while it's looking for you, you can get second degree or manslaughter charges for that kind of thing. That happened to a guy years ago in Southern California. This poor guy was using illegal fireworks with his son in some dry brush area, just trying to have fun with fireworks for the 4th of July, and it started a fire, and one of the fire department helicopters crashed while battling the blaze, and the father found himself up on charges for that, even though it was understood by everyone that he wasn't actually trying to get anyone killed. He was just being reckless. So the only way you can really effectively fake your own death is in the ocean. The Sleeping with the Enemy, that Julia Roberts film, that method, because when a body's lost at sea, there's very, very limited resources that will be committed to finding it, especially if you leave a suicide note
Did
behind.
you tell your family you were going to do it, or did they think you were dead?
Oh no, I would never have done that to my family. Everybody close to me knew the actual circumstances. I never would have put anyone through anyone I loved or who loved me. I never would have put them through that. Everybody knew it was coming, and everybody knew what was going to play out. And it was as I, it worked, because it was the only really good way you can do that, unless you want to take the time and effort to travel to some really dangerous part of the world and pretend to die there. Like, you tell your family, I'm going to Sri Lanka, or I'm going to East Timor. I'll see you guys later, and then you just never come back and leave it to the Timor police to find you. But that takes a great deal of money and time and effort. When you live in LA and you've got access to the mighty Pacific Ocean, well, there you go. That's the best place to do it.
So you started this Hollywood Republican Club, but how did you so obviously you reinvented yourself as David Stein. So what gave you the cred so you, what gave you sort of the credentials to do that? Because obviously you had to create a new persona. Did you say you were some Hollywood big shot, like a producer?
Well, I didn't have to say that, because in the interim, after I became Stein, I actually did start to produce films. Some of them were very mainstream Holocaust movies, including a film called Nuremberg, which was the last movie of the legendary Academy Award-winning screenwriter Bud Schulberg, who did On the Waterfront and The Harder They Fall and A Star Is Born and all of those great classic films. So by the time I got interested in politics as an actual full-time endeavor, I already had a good deal of legitimate, respectable credits as David Stein. I didn't have to present myself as anything that I wasn't, because I had become that person, and I had a pretty decent resume. So when I began working with the Hollywood GOP crowd, they simply had to Google me or look me up on IMDb to see what I had done. Obviously, all of that is unusable now because people have gone to my IMDb page and they've started message boards about who I really am and added lots of stuff. I mean, I can no longer use that David Stein page to impress anyone. But at the time, it was a pretty impressive looking page, and the credits could be verified. That was one of the hardest things for some of my GOP Hollywood friends to deal with, was they didn't know what to do with those credits. Some of them said, oh, those credits must be fake, and others of them said, no, I don't think he has any credits at all. The funniest conspiracy theory was that I stole the David Stein identity from a dead guy. I love this one because it's just hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, David Stein, that sounds like such a sort of generic, like, Jewish name.
Oh, that's why I picked it. I picked it because just try to find one David Stein in a haystack of Jews. You'll
find. Yeah, I mean, just open up the phone book for lawyers in L.A.
Yeah, and some of my former GOP friends, they saw that at the end of 2004, I think December of 2004, a guy named David Stein died. And guys named David Stein die every year. But this one had stubble. I have stubble. I don't like being clean shaven. So they're like, huh, the end of 2004, a David Stein with stubble dies. And this David Stein, who adopted that name, has stubble. But I had been David Stein for a good 6 years before that other unfortunate David Stein passed away. But I just thought it was a funny conspiracy theory, this notion that I looked for a David Stein with stubble to take his name. But people will believe anything if they're angry enough or if they're gullible enough. And some of my former GOP friends were both angry and gullible.
And it's been compared to someone called it, like, the Republican Sodom and Gomorrah. And I see that picture of you. You have, it's hilarious. You have your shirt off, and this girl is, like, pinching your nipples.
That was what set us apart, Robert, was when people would come to my Republican Party Animal events, there would be rock and roll music, and there'd be really, really, really beautiful women there. There would be dancing, but there'd also be congressmen and radio talk show hosts and other politicians. We had people from the Bush administration, we had people from the Reagan administration, and we had several current congressmen who would be our regulars. But there'd also be, as the hour went on.
You don't have to say anything, but I'm sure you have a lot of dirt on congressmen.
Well, the most of the congressmen who I worked with were really decent and nice people. However, and I can say this because I tell the story in the book, one of the congressmen who was one of my biggest fans with my Republican Party Animal group, a guy named Thaddeus McCotter, he was a congressman from Livonia, Michigan. He was a Republican who was in an incredibly safe district. It was a district where the district was so Republican that he never really bothered to campaign all that much. And he would get elected time and time and time and time again because his district was 100% secure. And Thad was a cool guy. Thad McCotter played guitar, and he was a master of pop culture references. He was a frequent guest on the Fox News late night show Red Eye, because he was just a master of the media and of speaking a language that younger people.
I wonder if Red Eye got the idea, got inspired by you, because I think the show on Fox News, it sets itself apart from from someone like Sean Hannity's all uptight because that guy Greg Gutfeld, he's always making sex jokes. I think he probably got inspired by you a little bit.
Well, as much as I would love to take that compliment, because I think Greg Gutfeld does a great job, and so I'd love to take the compliment, but I think if we were to look at everything, if we were to try to distill everything to its core, I think everybody got inspired by Andrew Breitbart. I think that Breitbart was he was the first person to really propose this kind of pop culture conservatism where you can be funny, where you can tell even off-color jokes. Breitbart, of course, was on the scene before me, and I wouldn't want to take credit for anything that I can't honestly take credit for. So I think Breitbart would probably have to be seen as the main inspiration. However, we were all part of the same group, the Hollywood Republican group, Friends of Abe. Greg Gutfeld, Breitbart, me, Congressman McCotter. This was a big melting pot, witch's cauldron, it'd probably be a better way to put it, where all of these guys, where we all met, exchanged ideas, talked, got together for events, sometimes got together just to drink. So the Friends of Abe melting pot, that's kind of the petri dish where a lot of this came from. But I would have to go back and give Breitbart the initial props for really getting all of it going.
Who were some of the biggest celebrities that you had there?
Well, in terms of the Friends of Abe, where I had been working with them for, because there's two different organizations. There's my own Republican Party Animals, which is the one that I created, and then there's Friends of Abe, which was created by Gary Sinise, Kelsey Grammer, and several other, and Clint Eastwood and several John Voight and several other Hollywood conservatives. We all worked together. There was much crossover. I worked with Friends of Abe for 5 years, and Friends of Abe people took part in my Republican Party Animal events during that time as well. The Friends of Abe, mainly because of Gary Sinise's star power and personal charm, we got people from Condi Rice and Dick Cheney and John Boehner, Karl Rove. When Boehner became Speaker of the House, the first thing he did, about 2 weeks after officially becoming speaker, is he flew out to LA to thank us at Friends of Abe for our support. Friends of Abe was an extremely important organ for the GOP because it gave the GOP access to Hollywood money and Hollywood know-how. Not just the money, the know-how was equally important because shooting commercials, giving them advice. As an example, I give in my book, when Michael Steele was the head of the Republican National Committee, he no longer is, but when he was, it was his appearance at Friends of Abe that where he first learned why does the GOP always give its response to the State of the Union address with one guy alone in front of a mic? Why not have an audience? There's no law against it. When the president gives a State of the Union speech, there's a humongous audience. There's both houses of Congress and the Supreme Court and a gallery of friends and onlookers. Why must the response always be given by one lonely dude in front of a mic in an echo chamber where there's no one else around? So Michael Steele, because of what he learned from us at Friends of Abe, the next GOP rebuttal to the State of the Union, there was a full audience there. Because when you have an audience, you get applause and laughs. And to the viewer watching it on TV or listening to it online or on the radio, every point that the speaker makes sounds better. It sounds better when it's accompanied by laughs and applause rather than Bobby Jindal, who's another man who I worked with. But Jindal, he's got kind of a high voice, not the most pleasant voice. And so you put Bobby Jindal in front of a mic all by himself, well, it's just going to sound sad. We convinced the RNC to actually use an audience for once, and I feel at least it made the rebuttal much stronger.
So, before I wrap up the show, I'll ask you, what are you, what are you, do you have any like current projects, and what do you see yourself doing in the future?
Well, right now, the rest of the summer is entirely dedicated to promoting and supporting my book. That may extend beyond the summer because it's going to be a challenge, Robert. It's going to be quite a challenge with the media blackout. I have to fight much harder to even just get the ball rolling. The book's been out and available now for about 10 days, and I already see the challenges mounting before me, and I'm talking with my publisher on a daily basis about what we can do to let people know the book is out there. Obviously, all of my extended family on Facebook, all my friends on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere, they all know about it, and most of them have bought it. But we need to reach the people in a much broader way, and so we're working on that. And that's going to be that might take up the entire rest of this year. After that, I honestly don't know. Usually, I've been fortunate in that projects and opportunities find their way to me. It's one of the few areas in my life where I can say I've always had a bit of a lucky charm about me in that manner. If I had that kind of luck with women, boy, I'd be a happy, happy son of a bitch. But in terms of finding projects, they tend to find me. So the rest of the year is probably going to be about my book, and then I'm simply going to see what rears its head.
Well, David Cole, I'd like to thank you for being on.
It's been my pleasure, Robert. I really enjoy your show, and I enjoyed doing this interview. I think you're doing a wonderful job, and I thank you for having me on.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.